sharing of information and knowledge. It's particularly useful because it alludes, for me anyway, to the need to address. But put succinctly, if you like, interoperability is about having varying degrees of conversation and enjoying various degrees of richness within those conversations. And the other thing about interoperability that we've seen is it's a proven approach for dealing with the diversity and complexity. It's also pretty useful to recognise that we think of interoperability at different levels or aspects, from purely technical, if you like, to right over here on the right to sort of socio-political. And all these elements need to be addressed, we think, which I'll come to later on in my framework. IBM introduced the PC. They published a set of technical specs. They weren't standards per se, but what they actually did do is that they enabled third parties to develop peripherals, and those peripherals then created a healthy ecosystem around them. At that stage, the most important kind of interop that people thought about was connecting up your 3270 terminal emulator, and then those APIs for its operating system, even though they were proprietary, they did enable the development of a reasonably robust ISV community, which built a business model around that. So if you can see what's been happening here, is we're gradually building up, even though through proprietary protocols, etc., we're building up and got a competitive market developing for multiple companies actually providing different kinds of protocols. And you probably remember some of them, IPX, SPX, NetBIOS, Vines. When the market then reached a critical mass, that's when customers started to demand interoperability on a larger scale, because they started to feel the pain. Well, when the market reached that critical mass, then the problem started to get solved by things like TCP/IP, open standard. So we've had proprietary standards developing, then an open standard coming in to solve that mishmash of problems. Today, all manufacturers support TCP/IP. Once we've got TCP/IP enabled, resources and presentation across networks, and that's where we then started to get HTTP, and we started to get HTML. So we started to get the ability for a browser to actually present a page, irrespective of the implementation that was underlying at some other endpoint. And then with the evolution of these, customers then started to realise that, rather than just presentation, we can actually do business processes. We can share more complex scenarios. So we got conversations happening in a much greater degree of richness, even though it was at a primarily technical level. And that's where we've seen this whole move towards XML and web services to deal with this particular issue. And that's also... So what do we learn from this history? Well, it's fairly clear to see that the customer demand is the key driver. And not only that, but this occurs in stages. We see a repeating pattern of stages. We first see an early stage where new technology development and multiple competing, often proprietary standards grow around some open standards. And those open standards then lay the new platform, if you like, for greater things to grow on top of that. You also see the higher up the stack you go, the greater the need for the industry itself to work together. And I think that's one of the reasons why we're really starting to see now, particularly as we get up here into the seamless... And so what I'd say is the last observation is that any business today that really hasn't got interoperability at the core of its technical strategy really hasn't got a viable business going forward. It's not going to satisfy customers' requirements. So building on this history, at least, is essentially not the issue today. I'd like to expand on this a little bit. We often hear about interoperability spoken of as this generic thing. It's this kind of woolly concept. But actually there are different bits to it that we need to look at in order to actually get the whole picture sorted out. I remember being on the customer interoperability, the ability to do all the stuff via the web, relied on a whole lot of different things that went beyond just firing bits of data back and forth. It was integrally connected with the kinds of business or the kinds of organisation you were and what you wanted to achieve and in certain contexts. So it's really, really important, I think, to have an understanding of, you know, what are the bits. We'll kind of understand this here, this level here, or these two levels, if you like. The physical, you know, the base platform infrastructure, your comms, how you connect the protocols that you use to do that, and operational infrastructure. And in many ways, it's starting now to include, you know, things like your app server and how you handle those things at that level. But then we get a little bit further from that, and further up, you know, what do things mean? Because unless you know what something means, it's very, very hard to deal with it. So for example, one system might think of a citizen as a taxpayer, another as a patient, and yet another as a student. And yet they may actually be exactly the same person. And if you attempt to interoperate or bring together processes and don't in any meaningful way. And interestingly, this is the area that Microsoft's working with Agimo to try and overcome. We have a project that we're working with them on called GovDex. And GovDex is really designed to work at this level around the whole idea of semantic harmonization. How do you get different departments, for example, semantically having a clear of legal, organizational, and process concerns? And that's really, really tough stuff. You're dealing with things like process. You're dealing with risk. How do we allocate risk in the transaction? What are the kinds of things that I need to think about with respect to privacy? Because what's private in this realm for perhaps a certain sort of record becomes very, very difficult. And so you get into an area at the higher level of the stack where it's very, very tricky, and as yet we haven't really seen a lot of progress made. But we need to. So I think that the tough work, in summary of this slide anyway, is really a lot more to do with the less to do with the technical implementations and a lot more to do with a little example here with something that many of you may know, either by virtue of working in the industry or at least, you know, hearing about it. The SWIFT network, good example of this. SWIFT connects all banks to a network, and that network allows them to do electronic funds transfer. SWIFT doesn't mandate the kinds of technology. Here's an example of what that message looks like. So beforehand, those issues of semantic interoperability, those issues of policy and context and so on have been dealt with. And at the technical level, at least, as long as someone puts a well-formed message into that system, it will be recognized and dealt with because that's been dealt with before. So this interoperability, as we move forward with interoperability in a more pervasive way, we want to get beyond having to do this offline. We want to be able to establish contexts, rules, policies ahead of time and have them represented in a way that facilitates interoperability more pervasively. But even at a purely technical level, interop is through product design. And that's an important starting point for Microsoft and others because we, in doing that, we lay a solid foundation of interoperability into the products we make now and going forward. And Microsoft's been doing this with, you know, XML being baked into all the products that they are developing and allowing, you know, that actually be overly valuable. We're also supporting the adoption of open standards. And open standards are an important way for us to achieve this and others. You can really see open standards having these sorts of characteristics. Now, they're regularly developed and maintained. They're ratified by consensus from the business model. And they're published without restriction, and they're publicly available at no cost or little cost. And any patent rights necessary for their implementation are made available by those developing the specifications to all the implementers, at least on RAND terms, reasonable and non-discriminatory terms. And that's important because these standards typically are ratified by ISO, ECMA, and a number of the others that you've probably already heard of. Really important point that I'd like to make here, though, is that we often hear of the word proprietary standards used of as a pejorative. And in fact, I think we shouldn't ignore the huge benefit that history, it was the proprietary ones that grew up and then created that critical mass that then allowed the open standards to in fact take root and be pervasive. And if we think about proprietary standards, we can define them really as, you know, technical specs that are developed by a single organisation or a closed group. There's nothing inherently wrong with that. Some of these ones, you know, Adobe PDF, for example, Java, Win32 APIs. And each of these has been able to provide value to customers. So I don't think we should throw the baby out with the bathwater. The other thing we believe in, and I know others do, other industry players, is the whole idea of market-driven industry collaboration. We've been doing it with Cisco around security. We've been doing it, established one with Sun around the interoperability with respect to our identity management. There's ones there, as you can see, Nokia and a number of others. I think at this point, too, it'd be useful for me to highlight between products and services, and that is either intended for widespread adoption or has already achieved that widespread adoption. And that makes sense because, of course, the more it's adopted, then the more utility it brings to those who use it and to the industry as a whole. So you can see that standards are important to interoperability because they provide the ability in a minute. Here's an example. Forgive me for this weird sounding thing on the left here, which most of you probably aren't familiar with. Suffice it to say, it's a standard. It's a standard that describes a common gateway interface for SIP. It's been developed through IETF. So it's all about the underlying technology that can implement it. On the right, however, what we've actually got is an implementation of this particular standard. It's a discrete piece of code. It's going to be implemented on a specific set of technologies. But this is the difference. One's the standard, the other's the implementation. They have standards, particularly if you've built your own homes or modified them recently. They have standards about how things should be done. So if you're building a masonry house, for example, they have standards around how the walls should be load-bearing to a certain degree, what load-bearing and other characteristics the roof needs to comply with, etc. Daylight required on the outside of the house, given that you need to make some provision for light courts. And even inside rooms, what's the kind of base level of light that you require in a room of certain functionality? What they don't do is they don't provide an implementation brick on brick. They leave that to those who implement. And they standard and many implementations. And the good thing about that is you have a lot of potential to have diversity and potentially competition. I thought I'd put this up because I really wanted to clarify it. I wanted to clarify it because, and I wanted to take a couple of minutes just to clarify that. So open standards are technical specifications ratified or approved using an open consensus-based approach. Open source software is software that's distributed under an approved OSS license. The opensource.org provides. That's the implementation. Other software to implement or not implement open standards in their products. And software that implements an open standard can be distributed under any license. So the business or licensing model is actually relevant to open standards. So the distinction I'm really making is they are separate things. Generally market-driven. Certainly the ones we've been seeing lately have been very, very much market-driven. And one of the benefits is they're more likely to enjoy a much greater commitment from those certainly who've been part of the collaboration process, and typically that's certainly the major players in the industry. And as a result of that, they're a lot more dynamic in the way they take root, when they take root. Because they're open, in addition, there's a benefit to the separation that occurs between the product, the development, and the business models that develop and use open standards. That separation of function, of concerns, if you like, we think is a really positive thing. And lastly, because the process is voluntary, it means that people who... So I've talked a little bit about open standards, interoperability, etc. But I felt it was really important also to table what's Microsoft doing in this whole area. Are we just talking about it, or are we actually doing something positive? And if we're doing something, what does it look like? standards, etc. So I'd like to just quickly go through and talk about what we're doing in those particular areas, and then give you a little bit more detail around some of the complementary things we're doing in addition to those. So firstly, we are building interop into the core of our products. We led the charge with XML web services quite a number of years back, certainly when it came to SOAP and a number of the very .NET. The other thing is that web services now are becoming essentially the primary mechanism, at least in a planning from now on sense, for many industry players, more and more industry players, in the way they think about developing products. Us not only develop standards, but it's also helping us interact with the wider IT community. So it's like a great place for us to actually work more effectively with the rest of the IT community. The other thing is Microsoft believes that access to an exchange of IP is really important. It's essential to growth and development of a robust IT. A lot of the patents, if you like, a lot of the material that we had, and what should we be doing with it? We should be making it available. And so in December 2003, Microsoft announced that it would in fact be making its IP portfolio available for license at reasonable and non-discriminatory terms. Since that announcement, we've announced for display technology, FAT file system, which many of you may know, and then the royalty-free Office XML schemas. These things we've made available to people so that we can, again, try and get that ecosystem even more vibrant, because we believe it's important. We're also trying to help customers even further by working with partners and folk as well, and people like Oracle. So at every single layer, if you like, Microsoft is working with the industry on both collaborative things and about specific product things as well. And we'll come to a little diagram of that in a couple of slides. In addition to that, the Office 2003 XML licensing program has enabled us to open up, and it allows governments to really understand and adopt or not adopt those XML schemas. Under the shared source program for Windows and Office, for example, we've actually made available not only the code, but also a lot of the communications protocols, etc., which are used, which are proprietary, but are used in the Microsoft offering, the source code. And the other thing we do is not just provide the source code, that we provide extensive technical training. It's kind of interesting because we have such a large amount of Microsoft operating system and Office out there, it's useful for governments to be able to look at that and feel comfortable that there's nothing in there. So we've made that available and they're using that now. And the last one's binary format licensing. Governments have some challenges around being able to do security reviews, archiving requirements that mean that with binary files they need to know how they're made up so that in time to come, they can act. Forensic examinations is another one. So we've made available this, again, through a fairly comprehensive licensing agreement which enables access and utilisation of these things. But for those who are actually designing and deploying technology, interoperability up and down the stack is the key thing that they want to have solved. And really just give you a bit of a quick snapshot of some of the things that we're doing. I think you can see it's pretty extensive. You know, pretty much everywhere you'd expect to see interoperability, there is. We're making efforts. And this is specifically at product-to-product level. So MIIS, for example, helps Microsoft's products to integrate identity information and provide a unified view. Macintosh, if you've got a Microsoft server and a set of Macintoshes that are communicating with that, interoperating with that, we've now made it possible for them to share files and resources and printing and all those things that they need to do seamlessly with services for Macintosh. And Host Integration Server, which is just an incredible thing that very few people acknowledge, so that you can leverage those assets much more effectively. So that all your SNA stuff that you've probably been using for years is now able to have a broader life than it had before. In fact, one of the large banks, Commonwealth Bank, has been leveraging that particular technology in order to do just that. So it goes beyond just making a name for or making a future for Microsoft to interoperate with the rest of the world, but via web services provides a mechanism for all sorts of technology to access mainframes and mid-ranges. This is an interesting slide too, and I really thought before I put this up, but I thought, no, it's right across the map, not just in web services, for example, but also, you know, right across the whole IT landscape. We're actually providing, embedding in, if you like, those various standards and interoperating with them. It's a pretty comprehensive picture. And as you can see at the bottom, we're also working on... Microsoft's also getting a fair amount of positive feedback around the things that we're doing, and particularly with interoperability. And I don't want to take up too much time going through all of this, but I just want to take you very quickly through a few snapshots of what others, particularly in government and elsewhere, are saying basis on the source code project. We've got Helge Sander from the Minister of Science and Technology and Innovation in Denmark. He sees value in how we're listening, taking on board what his government's needs are, and actually then responding so that it meets his needs. We've got Otto Schily, Minister of the Interior for Germany. Now, he's in the area of open standards. Now, it's made a difference to their work. And lastly, we're seeing now analysts acknowledging more generally that, you know, Microsoft kind of gets it. It is a big deal to Microsoft, this interoperability thing. We haven't seen that for a while. So now that we've covered off the need for what government might like to consider, and the rest of the industry as a tool as we move towards a richer set of conversations in our quest for interoperability and openness. So I suggest that the key components of interoperability framework for e-government should include these things. Clearly defined policy. A basis for the use of broadly available tower and technology used. Systems are able to work together. Also provide guidance on which open standards and broadly licensed proprietary standards are actually available. Might sound dumb, but if you think about it, it level sets people's understanding of, you know, what's out there, what makes sense, what do we all collectively consider as age. And also a well-defined approach to legacy integration. Really important. There's a lot of it out there, and there will be for some time to come. So we need to think about that in terms of a framework in order to be able to successfully leverage this pretty heavy investment that particularly government has in this whole area. Terms and catalogue language used to describe the various components are in fact consistent. This is the thing I talked about before that we're working with AGIMO with a specific project. Now that's a start, that's great, but I think in terms of an overall framework that addresses this area, we need to consider that as a pivotal part. A security framework, with identity management. We need to think about complex security policies and how they're communicated. We need to encapsulate that into a set of standards that enable government to successfully interoperate at that richer level. A set of reusable and common components that act as an enabler. This is the whole, I guess, taking on to a next level, the whole large applications centralised so we can get some operational efficiency out of that. Nothing wrong with that. But going forward, I think there's a lot of value in saying what are some of the common processes, the common services that are required across government, and how can we leverage those more successfully? Well, one of the ways we need to think about doing that is within a framework that's all about interoperability, a program called Solution Sharing Network that I run, and we're doing exactly that. We're providing a specific tool to many government agencies, we've already got a number of them about to be implemented, to allow them to start the process of collaborating towards reusing IT. So it's an interesting piece of businesses and government agencies, and of course to drive take-up. So to conclude then, government plays, for me anyway, a critical role in enabling and promoting this whole area of interoperability and open standards, and therefore fostering openness. And so I'd like to... The current ecosystem has a good level of interoperability that should continue and be encouraged and protected. And this was what I was talking about with, you know, vendors starting now to move and to cooperate, some of the lower level stuff we've seen. That's existing. Great. Let's keep that going. Government should support open standards as an excellent way. Standards that, for example, in the consumer electronics market where we had VHS and Beta, that the market and the consumers should be the ones that determine what technology standards are taken up, even when that technology may not be the most elegant solution technically. Also, the government, any of these, we believe, will inhibit innovation and choice. You need collaboration and you need agreement. You've got to work through that process, even though it can be pretty painful at times. Intellectual property protections. Commercial companies need to rely on a broad range of intellectual property laws, including trademark, that we need to sustain businesses, but they actually provide organisations with the impetus, if you like, to commit resources in order to foster innovation. And we think the IP protections play a really important role in fostering the growth of open standards, because they ensure that open standards can actually be implemented by all model. I think we've seen agreement with that in this morning's release. So lastly, I just want to say again, I've really appreciated the opportunity to speak to you, to be included in this set of discussions. And I also look forward, I guess, to go forward. Thank you very much. Yeah, I think it's patents can be brought into standards without people realising they're being brought into standards. And they do two things. Number one is they potentially compromise the vendor, if you like, if it's a vendor that's brought them in, being able to do other things with them down the track. And the other thing is that we need to get a clarification was sender ID. Sender ID was an area we found really, really challenging, and it took an incredible amount of dialogue with open standards organisations and industry players to start progressing that through. Why? Because Microsoft, not only Microsoft but others, had patentable material that was inherent in that set of recognising and granting of specific rights, or by simply gifting or whatever. But never, what I'm getting at is that we need to deal with that. Because if we see intellectual property rights as an important part of this whole area, we need to actually make sure that we address them. So there's really more about addressing them and understanding them.
So do you see that sender ID technology has ever
happened? Is that we'll get a number of different frameworks, a number of different ID technologies that evolve. And certainly, I mean, that just for people who aren't aware, this was a... basically a framework which took some of the work that Microsoft did, another set of work around policies that a chap called Meng Wong did, and it brought them together into one place, the logic being that you could get an ID be adopted by AOL and a number of others. Is that going to be the exclusive one? Probably not. But I think the important thing here is that, you know, Microsoft really wanted to do something to help against spam, and this was one way. But in recognition of this earlier question, we wanted to do it in the context of making sure that IP was dealt with properly and that it was done in an orderly manner.
So you've got to refine and kept IP rights if you have them, because you don't know if the patents never come to a court.
Yeah.
You chose to keep them rather than allowing the standards process to go ahead and implement the best solution for everyone. And that's at the core of the problem with the whole thing with software patents.
I think the essence of why we were uncomfortable and remain uncomfortable with the GPL is with the challenges of downstream exploitation of those rights and our ability to exploit certain elements of patent that we had in that standard. So that's kind of what hit that. I think the bigger challenge, and you're absolutely right, around the patent and IP system is that it's a real problem worldwide. It's all around the world. And you probably heard Microsoft is trying to move that debate forward as well, in terms of providing an easier mechanism for it. I'm not aware of the fine details of yeah.
Oasis have adopted the open office format as a standard for office documents.
Mm-hmm.
And National Archives have adopted that as a standard format to archive Australian government documents. It means they have the problem of translating all the Microsoft documents into that format. Is there a prospect of Microsoft adopting that standard format?
Things in terms of creating the XML versions of our documents format so that just that interoperability can be achieved. That interoperability essentially works by having the XML schemas, etc., that allow others to understand, and therefore, you know, you can provide filtering, etc., for that to occur. Here's the issue we face. We want to innovate, are not representable easily in XML, for example. So do we give those up and compromise innovation in order to meet a simple, you know, backwards compatibility with that spec? We've chosen not to do that. What we believe is if we look at the wide swathe of requirements from both governments and commercial organisations, we've satisfied that with the XML file formats and all other information that would be necessary in order to deal with those sorts of problems. So that's the thinking on that. If you give me a card, I will send you a link.
It's not on the website, I just
download it. There are both. It's about getting an agreement, right?
Why should I have an agreement?
A rat hole here. My alias is gstone, G-S-T-O-N-E, at Microsoft.com. And I'm really happy to point you to a lot more richer information around this whole area. Because I understand, you know, a lot of this stuff isn't necessarily as upfront as you might like it to be. So I'm happy to help you to get to that.
In difference to our next speaker.
Very end, but that's okay. I see the Microsoft speakers already left the building. That's good. Okay, fine.
We did.
It's actually been a very interesting day today. I guess we've heard about informed neutrality at the federal level, and then we've had to sit through Microsoft lecturing us on open standards, which I found fascinating. I couldn't bring myself to ask any questions I could actually utter in public. Anyway, having said that, I was asked to talk about the journey our company... In fact, we've been making the journey internally for longer than we've actually had it as a product line. I guess I want to take you through some of the thinking behind that. It gives you an opportunity to understand what's in the mind of a vendor when they do things. Hopefully we'll also shed a bit of light onto how does somebody actually make money from something like open source and Linux, because it's a sort of mystery. And it was one of these things about they just didn't get it. You know, he didn't understand it was software socialism, it was evil, it was everything else. So how did it work? And so it made me think about it a lot as well. So some of those arguments that I sort of thought about will come out during the course of my talk. We can see that we see some other technologies that are falling by the wayside. I guess in the debate of Linux and open source, a loss to Microsoft or a win for Microsoft is not a loss for the open source area. I guess it was interesting because I was once asked that, and I said at that point, well, Microsoft don't have a Linux strategy, therefore we're not in competition with them. But for those people who would like to have a Linux future, then we have something for them. And I guess that's sort of how I'd like to progress this debate and let my anger subside. People fill out a form and we put statistics down. This is from Netcraft as of a couple of weeks ago. And we see up the top there, Apache, open source web server, hands down, the market leader. 70%, that's about as big a share as you're ever going to get. And down there, the clearly open standards implemented IIS, using it for some time. And that's a great argument. Interestingly enough, that particular graph, I happen to use that as an argument about the FUD that gets thrown up to say that open source, therefore, is clearly less secure because everyone can see the code and everyone can hack it, etc. So why is it that Apache appears to be a pretty much simple counter-argument because it just happens to be so, that's what's really happening, as opposed to how you want to spin it. So people are using it and it's got a very high growth. Now this started occurring to Novell at the end of the 1990s. And we'd actually been playing around with open source, but in Novell's usual high servers, we've been helping OpenLDAP. In fact, all of the C libraries for OpenLDAP were donated by Novell, though we didn't tell anybody. In more recent times, we've done things like open source Yast, create the Hula project, we gave 300,000 lines of code from a product called Netmail, and we've done a few things like that, participation at a project level. So we have our engineers also working part of the Apache team, the Tomcat team. Now the reason we do that is not because we are really altruistic and kind of out there guys. We do it because we used to make our own proprietary web server, used to ship with NetWare. Until we realised that this Apache stuff's actually pretty good. Again, you know, a very proprietary platform like NetWare, in fact today, which you can still buy NetWare, yes, don't look so incredulous, you can still buy it today. A lot of people use it here in Canberra as well. It uses Apache, supports Perl, PHP, Python, ships with Tomcat out of the box. So it actually has a whole raft of open source pieces that occurred to, again, like any commercial organisation, you only have so many resources, you're going to do so many things. So if we wanted to refocus on doing other things, we had to say, look, if good code already existed that was well maintained, solid and reliable, then why don't we use it? Which is exactly what we did. But you also have to support the community. So every time we help Apache brick and gets back a house, which is exactly what we've done. So we give code up, we get great stuff back. And the other key saying is how we make money out of it, which is open source is free, providing you don't value your own time. And so there's a maintenance and support aspect, which we'll talk about. So at that stage on a cross-platform approach, we'd already worked out at that stage you needed to be interoperable. And so we brought it out to support a lot of platforms. And Linux was one of them. We brought out a directory and so forth. In fact, one of the things we stated early on in the piece was we didn't specifically, or in fact, we didn't want to bring out a Linux distribution. We said, look, we've already got a distribution because we're encouraged to do so. So what you're seeing, I guess, is the fruits of one of those five-year journeys sort of that Star Trek used to take on, and sort of exploration of the whole universe. So we started with NetWare and our dalliance was including a lot of open source stuff. And then we brought out a whole bunch of Linux services, or services that ran on Linux, things like our meta directory and directory services. And we packaged those up. And then finally we acquired a Linux company, Zimian. And the real nice thing about Zimian was that Zimian had worked out how to do open source and how to make. That's probably one of the key things about the open source community. There are some very talented individuals there who really love what they're doing. Now, these guys had worked out how to turn a Linux desktop, which arguably 3 or 4 years ago looked about as interesting as a Unix console, into something that actually looked pretty okay, and you could look at and show people. And that had created a project called the GNOME Project. McGuill actually later went on, he founded a project called Mono Project, which my friend from Microsoft would be interested in, because we've taken their published specs for .NET and implemented .NET on open source, for those of you unaware of the Mono Project. So we acquired Zimian, and we said, and then we turned around and said, you know, what was happening was our customers are saying, I like Linux, but what we really need is a closer ability to provide service to people. And the only way we could do that was to say, have our own distribution. Because we realised it came down to service. It was not good enough to say, well, at arm's length, we can interface with to get you the best possible service. Which sort of stuck with our model. For all the things people say about Novell, our software works, it continues to work, and when it doesn't, we fix it, and very quickly. So it was actually in keeping with our tradition. And it was funny, when we were actually looking to acquire SUSE, and you couldn't think of a match between Nuremberg and Germany. It has disaster written all over it, doesn't it? Right? Apart from the fact that they actually shared a fairly similar humour, the Germans and those people living in Utah. So that was probably to their benefit. But what we did find was that the engineering teams, and here's the interesting part, it has to be their best possible effort every time. So the basic fundamentals that we'd always been making in our software products rang true with these guys. And so, in fact, our engineering teams work exceedingly well together. I was in Provo a few weeks ago with a bunch of Americans and a bunch of Germans in Provo having dinner at a Indian restaurant. And that was actually working real well. In fact, we're teaching German lessons to the guys in Provo so they can better understand their colleagues. And so then we acquired the SUSE company. So they went from 400 guys in Nuremberg to now a presence that's worldwide. And when people think about it, they say, well, you know, SUSE wasn't a name we actually heard and understood in this region. Brought out another distribution, a 2.6 kernel distribution of our SUSE Linux Enterprise Server, and a Linux desktop, which I'm using here today. So if my screensaver dies, you won't see Windows. But the interesting thing is, I've still got all of these questions. It sounds good, but, you know, is it really secure? I like the comfort of predictable software. Software that you know when you do certain things to it, you always end up with the same result. So that was a challenge for us, to make software that could do that for you. And I really wish he was still here, but he's gone. But I'll send him the slides.